Tune Review and Speaking to the Blind, celebrating 40 years of audio newspaper production. Welcome to this week's edition of the National Podcast, recorded at the Bishop Briggs Media Centre by our amazing volunteers. You can get in touch with us via Facebook, Twitter or Instagram using @TuneReview, that is @CUEANDREVIEW. You can also contact us directly by emailing information@tunereview.com. That is information@CUEANDREVIEW.com or by calling 0141 772 3976. That's 0141 772 3976.
This is from The National on Friday the 4th of August 2023, from the politics section. Jeremy Vine panned for Scottish independence fired comments. This article is written by Lucy Garcia. Jeremy Vine has been condemned for his comments on Scottish independence, which saw him suggest that someone who spoke about the topic on the job should be fired by the person whose landmark court battle saw that very act ruled unlawful. Chris McElhinney, now the General Secretary of the ALBA Party, won a legal battle against the Ministry of Defence, MOD, after alleging that he had been suspended from his role with the government department after announcing a bid to run for deputy leader of the SNP back in 2016. McElhinney, at the time an electrician for the MOD, then alleged he had been questioned by a security vetting team on his suitability for clearance, which had been revoked. A 2018 employment tribunal ruled, and the next year reaffirmed, that his belief in Scottish independence could be considered a philosophical belief for the purposes of protection from discrimination under the Equality Act 2010. The 2019 reaffirmation confirmed it would be unlawful to dismiss someone from their job on the basis of a belief in Scottish independence. However, broadcaster Jeremy Vine sparked controversy on Thursday when he suggested that a boss may fire someone on those grounds. During a segment on his Channel 5 show talking about political talk in the workplace, Vine said, "An example of it would be where I think if you're a boss, you might object if you were in Scotland and you've got someone who wants to talk about Scottish independence, and we know that's very divisive. That's going to really set the cat among the pigeons, and so you might want to take them on one side and say, look, for or against doesn't matter, just put a sock in it when you're working here or you're fired." McElhinney said Vine should reflect on his comments. The ALBA secretary said, "It's no surprise that TV hosts will say controversial things to get attention, and in that regard, Mr. Vine is no different or worse than anyone else. However, he should reflect that there should be a line drawn at promoting unlawful discrimination against people across Scotland that believe in our right to self-determination. Many people faced discrimination in the workplace back in 2014, making them scared to support independence publicly in case it would jeopardise their livelihoods. Thanks to the 2019 decision, this is no longer the case, and employers should take note of this." That article was written by Lucy Garcia. This is from The National on Friday the 4th of August 2023, from the politics section. Labour call for greater use of private sector in NHS care. This article is written by Xander Eliards. Labour have been criticised after they called for greater use of private sector capacity in the NHS. Keir Starmer's party were accused of saying the quiet part out loud after they said that the UK government should use more privately owned health services to deliver NHS care. The party insisted the healthcare would remain free at the point of delivery, a founding principle of the NHS, but private firms would be paid by the government to provide care. Wes Streeting, the Labour's Shadow Health Secretary, said, "The Conservatives are failing to make use of private sector capacity and patients are paying the price." If Labour had been in office since January last year, more than 330,000 people would have received the treatment they desperately need. Instead, patients face record waiting times while the Tories dither and delay. He added, "No one should be waiting in pain while hospital beds that could be used lie empty." The next Labour government will use spare capacity in the private sector to get patients seen faster. The party claimed that 331,000 patients waiting for NHS care since January 2022 could have been treated already if the government had made full use of spare capacity in the private sector. A press release from the party went on. Private providers claim they can treat 30% more NHS patients than were being treated before the pandemic. But NHS figures reveal that for more than a year, the number of patients treated using private sector has been consistently below that. It added, "Labour has committed to using private sector capacity to bring down NHS waiting lists in the short term, as part of the national mission to build an NHS fit for the future. That is where people need it, by training the next generation of NHS staff and modernising the health service." The commitment to bring more private sector contracts into the NHS was criticised by the Scottish Greens, who said it was the last thing the health service needs. MSP Gillian Mackay said, "Labour is saying the quiet part out loud. The last thing the NHS in England needs is more private sector involvement. Far too much of it has already been sold off and privatised by successive Labour and Tory governments." Unfortunately, this is entirely consistent with the approach that the UK Labour leadership has taken. The answer is not a greater private sector influence, it is investment in frontline staff and services. "With Scottish Greens in government, we will always stand for the publicly owned NHS that is based on human need and not corporate profits." Health is devolved, meaning Labour will not have power over the Scottish NHS, even if they win power at Westminster at the next general election. Streeting is due to appear at the Edinburgh Fringe in conversation with Ian Dale on Monday, August the 7th. The National will be covering the event. That article was written by Xander Eliards. This is from The National on Friday, the 4th of August, 2023, from the news section. Leading authority on heat pumps backs Scottish Government's plans. This article is written by Ross Hunter. The UK's leading authority on heat pumps has backed the Scottish Government's recent proposals aimed at increasing deployment of the technology. Ministers have committed to installing 170,000 new heat pumps by 2030 in off-gas grid properties and are consulting on whether to ban the installation of fossil fuel heating in new-build homes from April 2024. The government is also exploring whether to downgrade the energy efficiency rating, EPC, of homes with gas boilers compared to those with climate-friendly systems, such as heat pumps. It is all part of a wide-ranging strategy to remove fossil fuels from the heating systems of more than 1 million homes by 2030, an essential milestone if Scotland is to reach its net zero target by 2045. A new mobile training unit is also set to offer professionals training on how to install heat pumps, as well as the opportunity to gain the necessary qualifications. However, after Labour peer Lord Hoghy claimed that heat pumps were not a feasible alternative to heating homes with fossil fuels, the UK's leading authority on heat pumps, the Heat Pump Association, HPA, has backed the Scottish Government's plans and said they are crucial to a green energy future. The chief executive of the HPA, Charlotte Lee, said, "It is great to see Scotland reaffirming its commitment to support the deployment of heat pumps and consulting on steps to actively reflect how their low carbon nature through the EPC ratings." Furthermore, the opening of the new mobile training unit is a perfect depiction of industry and government working together to solve key challenges in the journey to decarbonising heat. These initiatives are crucial to securing a green future for Scotland. Figures show that there are currently 187 certified MCS heat pump businesses working in Scotland who have completed over 8,400 installations since 2022. But with a poll conducted by WWF showing that 40% of those surveyed would consider installing a heat pump as an alternative to fossil fuel boiler within the next 5 years, the HPA added that more installers will be needed to meet demand. And that article was written by Ross Hunter. This is from The National on Friday the 4th of August 2023, from the news section. Nessie hunters wanted to search for Loch Ness Monster. This article is written by Adam Robertson. The largest search for the elusive Loch Ness Monster in decades will get underway later this month. Staff from the newly revamped Loch Ness Centre at Drumnadh Rocket have teamed up with a group of independent and voluntary researchers, Loch Ness Exploration, LNE, to conduct the biggest surface water survey in more than 50 years. The centre is seeking more budding Nessie hunters to get involved in the search, which is planned for August the 26th to the 27th. The search is expected to be the largest of its kind since the Loch Ness Investigation Bureau studied the loch for signs of the mythical monster in 1972. Surveying equipment that has never been used on the loch before will be deployed to uncover the secrets of the mysterious waters. This will include drones, which will produce thermal images of the water from the air using infrared cameras, as it is believed observing heat from above could provide a crucial component for identifying any strange anomalies. A hydrophone will also be used to detect acoustic signals under the water, listening for any Nessie-like calls, as well as other technology that could prove useful in the search. The Loch Ness Sensor and LNE are looking for volunteers to keep an eye out for any breaks in the water or any other inexplicable movements over the weekend. Each morning, Alan McKenna from LNE will brief volunteers at the centre on what to look out for and how to record findings. There will also be a debrief in the afternoon to go through the day's events. The Loch Ness Centre is located at the old Drumnadh Rocket Hotel, where its said manageress Aldi Mackay reported seeing a water beast in Loch Ness 90 years ago. McKenna said, "Since starting LNE, it's always been our goal to record, study and analyse all manner of natural behaviour and phenomena that may be more challenging to explain. It's our hope to inspire a new generation of Loch Ness enthusiasts, and by joining this large-scale surface watch, you'll have a real opportunity to personally contribute towards this fascinating mystery that has captivated so many people from around the world." Paul Nixon, General Manager of the Loch Ness Centre, added, "We are guardians of this unique story, and as well as investing in creating an unforgettable experience for visitors, we are committed to helping continue the search and unveil the mysteries that lie underneath the waters of the famous loch. The weekend gives an opportunity to search the waters in a way that has never been done before, and we can't wait to see what we find." That article was written by Adam Robertson. This is from The National on Friday the 4th of August 2023, from the news section. Scottish Museum to review Glencoe Massacre exhibit as priority. This article is written by Xander Eliards. A landmark Scottish museum is to address the state of its exhibit on the massacre of Glencoe as a priority after concerns were raised, the National has been told. It comes after concerns about fading on the lettering of the information panel on the exhibit, which meant even the number of MacDonalds killed in the 1692 massacre was illegible. The exhibition in question is at the National Museum of Scotland, next to Greyfriars Kirkyard in central Edinburgh. Its aim is to educate visitors on the slaughter of at least 38 men, women and children from Clan MacDonald after King William III of England decided to make an example of them. Alasdair MacLean, the chief of the Glencoe MacDonalds, had been late in swearing fealty. The National Museum of Scotland exhibit was further criticised for reporting that only bad weather and misunderstandings prevented MacLean from taking the oath in good time. Chris McElhenney, the General Secretary of the Alba Party, said, "Scotland's story has been badly let down by a number of organisations over the years. It's quite common to see Scottish history after the mid-17th century written with a British tint. I would be hopeful that the National Museum of Scotland would address the aesthetics of their exhibit, but much more could be done to tell the story of the Glencoe MacDonalds. To believe that bad weather was the only barrier to swearing an oath of allegiance to William II of Scotland is naive at best and ignorant at worst." McElhenney went on, "The massacre at Glencoe has a much more complex origin, going back to Killiecrankie, and the bloody and brutal slaughter that also shocked all of Scotland at that time. Unfortunately for the Scottish Jacobite cause, the end of the Williamite War in Ireland in 1690 meant that there wasn't a Jacobite presence that could capitalise on the public mood, and sentiment in Scotland that was very unhappy with the brutal actions sanctioned by a foreign king based in London. If there is to be some investment to improve the condition of exhibitions, there would be merit in trying not to explain complex events of Scottish history that span several years on one simple info board on the wall." A spokesperson for National Museum Scotland said that the exhibitions were now 25 years old and would be reviewed as part of an ongoing programme of work. They said, "We regularly monitor damage to our displays and have a rolling programme of maintenance. The wear to this particular interpretation panel has already been logged and will be addressed as a priority." This display tells the story of the massacre of Glencoe within the specific context of the development of state power. The story of the Jacobite challenge is told elsewhere in the museum. "Our Scotland galleries are now 25 years old, and we are embarking on a programme of works to review and refresh them. Interpretation, including label text, will be reviewed as part of this project." That article was written by Xander Eliards.
From the National, Monday the 7th of August 2023, from the politics section, "Shameful. Scottish Greens slam UK's Ascension Island plans." Report by Adam Robertson. The Tories have been accused of lifting policies out of the far-right playbooks amid reports that they are planning to send asylum seekers to Ascension Island in the South Atlantic. It's been reported that ministers were resurrecting the plan, which was rejected as unworkable when floated in 2020. The idea was first proposed by former Home Secretary Priti Patel, although it was eventually scrapped. However, under new legislation, asylum seekers would be sent on a one-way flight to the island, rather than being taken to the overseas territory temporarily. It is reportedly being considered as an alternative to the government's Rwanda policy, which has been hit with legal challenges ever since it was first announced. Following the reports, the government is yet to deny that the Ascension Island plans are being discussed. Home Office Minister Sarah Dines told Sky News, "We are very confident that Rwanda is going to work, but, of course, lots of other alternatives are always discussed.
It wouldn't be right to talk about any particular country, but you would expect the government to look at additional measures. But we are very confident that Rwanda is going to work. Despite Dine's refusal to deny the plans, it has been reported in Politico that the Home Office does not recognise the plans. When asked why Ascension Island was suitable, the minister continued, "Well, I'm not going to confirm whether that's a possibility. We're looking at lots of different measures. We have discussions all the time, as any responsible government would, with many countries." The Times reported the UK government was in discussion with at least 5 countries. Dines added, "Times change. We look at all possibilities. This crisis in the Channel is urgent. We need to look at all possibilities, and that's what we are doing. We're determined to make sure there isn't the pull factor for illegal migrants to come to this country, basically to be abused by criminal gangs. These are international operations, and it's got to stop." In response to the reports, the Scottish Greens said that the Tories were continuing to pursue reactionary and inhumane policies. The party's justice spokesperson, Maggie Chapman, said, "Proposals like this expose how out of control and unfit for purpose the Home Office has become. What could be more abhorrent than pursuing these punitive and inhumane policies in order to punish some of the world's most vulnerable people? The Home Secretary is sadistically fanning the flames of prejudice and lifting policies out of far-right playbooks. It is the kind of shameful politics that used to be associated with racist thugs and extremist groups, but has now been implemented at the highest level of government." Rishi Sunak's official spokesperson said he would not comment on speculation following the reports around Ascension Island. They said, "We remain confident we will win the upcoming court case and continue our close relationship with the Rwandan government." The spokesperson added they would not be drawn into discussing specific speculation, although, when asked if they were in talks with other countries about Rwanda-style deals, they said, "We are broadly looking, as indeed are other European countries, to expand migration partnerships to other countries. But again, I'm not going to get drawn into who they may be or may not be." And that report was by Adam Robertson. From The National, Monday the 7th of August 2023, from the news section, GB News, Ofcom launches 4 investigations over impartiality rules. Report by Eli Iorizzo. Ofcom has launched 4 further investigations into GB News' compliance with due impartiality rules. The UK media watchdog said it is looking at 3 programmes, including an episode of Sir Jacob Rees-Mogg's show State of the Nation, in relation to its rule that politicians must not act as newsreaders, interviewers or reporters, unless exceptionally it is editorially justified. On June 13th, Rees-Mogg's show covered a stabbing incident in Nottingham which is being investigated, while Ofcom is also probing the Friday morning show from Esther McVeigh and Philip Davies, Conservative MPs for Tatton and Shipley respectively, on May the 12th, which included a discussion about a teenager who was being sentenced for terrorism offences. Saturday Morning with Esther and Philip, which aired on May the 13th this year, is also being examined, following an interview with Howard Cox, the Reform UK's party's candidate for the London mayoral election, who was speaking live from an anti-ultra-low-emission zone demonstration. It is also assessing the programme's compliance with the broadcasting rule, which requires that news, in whatever form, must be presented with due impartiality. Ofcom said it is also investigating an episode of Lawrence Fox on June 16, which was guest presented by Martin Dobney and featured an interview with Richard Tice, the leader of Reform UK. It included a discussion about immigration and asylum policy, particularly in relation to the issue of small boats crossing the English Channel. This episode is being probed in relation to the broadcasting rule, which requires that due impartiality is preserved on matters of major political or industrial controversy or those relating to current public policy, and that an appropriate wide range of significant views are included and given due weight, the media watchdog said. The investigations come months after Adam Baxter, director of broadcasting standards at Ofcom, said that the watchdog will be looking at GB News to see if the broadcaster is behaving itself following the channel breaching its broadcasting code with COVID claims for the second time. And that report was by Eli Yorizzo. From The National, Monday the 7th of August 2023, from the culture section. This ruined my day. Glasgow restaurant suddenly shuts down. By Kirsty Feerick. A Glasgow restaurant has suddenly shut down to focus on family. Dirty Fries Guys has announced they will be closing down on Wednesday, August the 6th. The popular restaurant in Port Dundas, North Glasgow, couldn't find new staff to sustain the business. It comes as members of the current team are expecting a baby and have young families and could no longer give the same time to the company. We previously reported on the restaurant when they first opened their doors in March, just 5 months ago. They had focused on serving homemade food for takeaway and delivery and are now urging punters to try their dishes before it's too late. The restaurant is located at 465 Pinkston Road and sells breakfast, burgers, loaded fries, wings and wraps, and more. Dirty Fries Guys posted on Facebook saying, "So, unfortunately, as of Wednesday we will be closing down. We can't find someone suitable to join the team and, with a baby on the way in just 2 months and a 1-year-old to think of, we have come to the decision that timing just isn't right for this wee venture. Babies aren't babies forever and we need this time right now to focus on families. So, if you want to try some top-notch scran, you better get down before Wednesday while stocks last." Customers are quick to respond in the comments with their own thoughts. Lorraine Ann McClellan said, "Very hard decision. You girls will not regret it. Lots of family fun time to enjoy before it flows by yous. X." Caitlin Scullion said, "This is the place I wanted to try." David McSally said, "This has pure ruined my day." Stacey Shaw said, "Oh no, gutted." Jill Henshaw said, "Congratulations, Phoebe. You're right, they won't stay small for long, and I'm sure you'll be serving up top scan again when they're bigger." Report by Kirsty Feerick. From The National, Monday the 7th of August 2023. From the culture section, Lena Dunham to be special guest at Edinburgh Arts Festival. By Gregor Young. Lena Dunham, the star of hit comedy drama series Girls, has been announced as a special guest at her performance during the Edinburgh Art Festival. The Golden Globe winner will join sculpture artist Lindsay Mendick for a conversation entitled Shameful Women on August 19th. Both women will speak openly and honestly about their personal experiences during the one-off event at Jupiter Artland, a contemporary sculpture park and art gallery on the outskirts of the city. Dunham is a writer, director, actor and producer who was born and raised in New York City. She wrote and appeared in HBO's Girls, which ran for 6 series and was nominated for 11 Primetime Emmys Awards. She has won 2 Golden Globes, a Writers Guild Award, and was the first woman to win the DGA Award for Best Director for a television comedy. Her prose has been published in The New Yorker, The Guardian, Vogue, Harper's Magazine and New York Times. Mendick works predominantly with clay and houses her artwork in lifelike installations, recreating scenes from her personal life. Her solo commission is currently presented across Jupiter Artland's galleries. It is her largest commission to date and presents a contemporary view of duality and supposed binaries between good and evil, virtue and depravity, and gender roles. The two women will come together at this year's Jupiter Rising Festival, which takes place at Jupiter Artland over a single night and will also feature live music, dancing, karaoke and DJ sets. Jupiter Artland founder and director Nikki Wilson said, "These two women bring their power of observation and relentlessly confessional instincts to cite their work in the most compelling medium themselves. This talk is not about women and shame. It's an exploration about shameful, proud women that transmute shame into observations that resonate with us all." Mendick does not shy away from confession and she presents unflinching observations of the power of drink. It's fun in its optimism, alongside the messiness and regret that it also inflicts. Kim McAleese, director at the Edinburgh Art Festival, said, "We are thrilled to collaborate with Jupiter Artland on this amazing one-night event, with such a fantastic range of collaborators and performers, and curated by active, important and exciting artists and arts workers. Our EAAF 2023 programme is one which seeks to platform local grassroots artists alongside those working globally, and is a programme which is deeply connected to feminist and queer practice. This event will be a key moment in our 2023 programme, and will also, of course, be a memorable day and night of art, music and dancing, and for people to come together. For further information about Jupiter Rising and to buy tickets, go to www.jupiterrising.art. That's www.jupiterrising.art. And the article was by Gregor Young.
From The National, Tuesday the 8th of August 2023, from the news section. Alex Chalk defends Lee Anderson's comments on migrants. By Adam Robertson. Justice Secretary Alex Chalk has defended Lee Anderson after the deputy chair of the Tory party said asylum seekers should fuck off back to France. Chalk defended the comments made by the Ashfield MP after just 15 migrants entered the floating accommodation off the Dorset course on Monday. The UK government has said that the barge, initially designed to fit around 200 people, has a 500-person capacity. Speaking to LBC about Anderson's comments, Chalk said, "Lee Anderson expresses the righteous indignation of the British people. Yes, he does it in salty terms, that's his style, but his indication is well placed." The Justice Secretary said France is a safe country and a signatory to the European Convention on Human Rights. "People should claim asylum in the first country. It's not like there should be an open shopping list of where you want to go," he said. He expresses himself in his characteristically robust terms, but there is a lot of sense, in my respectful view, in what Lee says. On those complaining about the accommodation, Anderson told express.co.uk, "If they don't like barges, then they should fuck off back to France." He added, "I think people have just had enough. They come, these people, across the channel in small boats. If they don't like the conditions they are housed in here, then they should go back to France, or better, not come at all in the first place." His comments came after charity Care for Calais said it had helped to have the transfer of several migrants moving to the barge cancelled. The charity's chief executive is among many people to have condemned the use of the barge to house asylum seekers. Steve Smith said, "Among our clients are people who have survived torture and modern slavery and who have had traumatic experiences at sea. To house any human being in a quasi-floating prison like the Bibby Stockholm is inhumane. To do so with this group of people is unbelievably cruel. Even just receiving the notices is causing them a great deal of anxiety." This article is by Adam Robertson.
From The National, of Tuesday the 8th of August 2023, from the comment section, Alan Dorans, "We need balanced reporting on the safety of ScotRail staff." In the 1919 magazine for August, the headline story is "A Rail Staff Find Themselves on the Wrong Side of the Tracks." The report tells us, "A survey of staff across the UK is expected to be published later this year with full details of the findings, but British Transport Police, BTP, board papers have revealed of the 62 ScotRail staff who responded, just 10 said they felt safe at work. And in a further blow, 88.7% said they were not confident in the BTP's ability to keep them safe while on trains or in stations." Lib Dem Justice spokesperson Liam MacArthur said, "No one should go to work and feel unsafe or as if they are at risk of violence. These initial findings highlight real concerns about staff's faith in the ability of the BTP to keep them safe. I hope these interviews will be carefully analysed to determine where risks lie and what can be done to improve working conditions. There is no balancing comment from a Scottish Government representative, only these statements from the fifth largest party in Scotland. All media outlets have a reputation to uphold and a responsibility to inform accurately. This report, however, is likely to increase anxiety among rail workers and travellers on the basis of quite inadequate evidence. ScotRail has more than 5,000 staff. The 62 who responded represent only just over 1%, 1 in 100, and even at that level represent what researchers call a squeaky wheel sample, not a scientific sample, and thus not necessarily representative of the wider population. Working out 88.7% from a sample of just 62 out of more than 5,000 is frankly ridiculous. It is very important that readers are made aware of the facts of violent crime in Scotland. Based on official statistics, crimes of violence fell last year and at 52.4 per thousand are at only just over half the level in England and Wales of 92.6 per thousand. It is really unacceptable that any media outlet, especially one with an otherwise good record, should allow partisan comments by a trade union and an opposition politician to make accurate and decontextualised claims unchecked and unchallenged. This article was by Alan Dorrance from The National of Tuesday the 8th of August 2023 from the comments section. Let's drill into the facts on Sunak's oil and gas claims. By Alan Petrie, co-chair of the Aberdeen Independence Movement. So, we had the flying visit from the UK Prime Minister, who came north for a desperate attempt to hold on to the few seats the Tories hold in the area. I'll be honest, what he had to say will have gone down well with many, but any boost will be short and will leave a very bad taste. First up, we welcome the long overdue announcement of the Acorn project getting Track 2 status. But call us cynical if you like. We have been here before, on countless occasions. After the fanfare of the announcement, it became very clear that no details of how and how quickly this project will proceed were available. It was little more than a photo shoot. Tier 1 carbon capture, utilisation and storage CCUS projects got the go-ahead 2 years ago and have not progressed one inch since. Holding our breath waiting for real progress on Acorn would be a very risky game. The sad thing is that we had a lead over the rest of the world on CCUS and have had to watch on as UK governments piss our lead against the wall. While the UK was dithering, other similar-sized nations to Scotland were getting on with it. Next year, the Green Sands project in Denmark will start the commercial injection of carbon into depleted ex-gas wells. Way back when Margaret Thatcher was in power, Scotland was leading the world in wind power. Then Thatcher went all in on gas and stopped all government support for research into wind power. Thatcher's short-sightedness and the UK's eggs-all-in-one-basket approach was Denmark's gain. The Danes quickly became the world leaders in wind energy. We now import wind turbines and expertise from Denmark. That means even if Scotland has the best wind resource in Europe, we are little but a service station for other nations' tech. The other big review from Sunak's flying visit has created enough spin and heat to power Scotland. But let's cut out the political noise that's been flying around from all sides about another auction round of oil and gas exploration licences. Sunak and the Tories have painted this in the North East as creating jobs and some form of Doric Donia utopia with 100 new exploration blocks of seabed open for bids. A lot of the reaction to this from non-North East voices on our own side has been unhelpful and been as off as selling a utopia. Let's look at the reality of this auction round. Up until recently, these auctions happened yearly. Last year was the first round held since 2019. Last year's auction had 930 blocks on offer. Only 258 of these blocks received offers. Each year, a large number of blocks are handed back with zero development having been carried out. The small percentage of blocks that then see exploration wells are mostly dry wells or uneconomic to get the oil out. According to OEUK, the current success ratio in terms of finding commercially extractable oil is around 20% per well drilled. In 2022, only 6 exploration wells were drilled at the time of steady high oil and gas prices. The problem is not a lack of blocks of seabed to explore. The North Sea Basin is the most explored basin in the world in terms of oil and gas. The problem is the easy oil is all gone and the big world players are gone as well from the North Sea. The small investment companies that remain don't have the capital to fund big new projects. So any new discoveries that are developed will be tiebacks to existing oil rigs, and this creates very few jobs. Plenty has been said about the fallacy of the claims that new oil and gas projects will lead to increased energy security or mean we don't have to import oil and gas. With 80% of our oil going for export and it's all sold on the open market, Sunak thinks we are all idiots. I don't personally buy into the leave it in the ground camp. Oil in itself is not the problem, but burning it is the problem. Oil is the building block of our modern world with countless uses. It is the most precious of materials that future generations will hold us in utter contempt for wasting by burning while destroying our environment. We will still likely be pulling oil out of the North Sea for decades, but the days of the oil industry being the bedrock of our economy and the way of life in the North East have gone. And it's long since time to rebalance our economy yet again. A new future awaits. Clinging to the sinking oil and gas ship will just mean we drown in decay. This article was by Alan Petrie.
From The National, Tuesday the 8th of August 2023, from the news section. Menstrie climber becomes sixth Scotswoman to climb. From The National, Tuesday the 8th of August 2023, from the news section. Menstrie climber becomes sixth Scotswoman to summit Mount Everest. By Chris Falls. A menstrie ski instructor has become the first Scottish woman to reach the summit of Mount Everest. Kirsty Mack, a ski instructor from Menstrie, got to the top of Everest at 8 a.m. local time on Monday, May the 22nd, along with her climbing partner, Lakpa Wongchu Sherpa. Daughter to the late mountaineer Tom Mack, Kirsty inherited her interest in mountaineering from her dad, who himself managed to complete several of the 7 summits, the highest mountains on each of the continents. Kirsty said it was an out-of-the-world experience to reach the summit and credited her dad with teaching her everything she knows. It was amazing, Kirsty said. It's so cool that you've got this technology now where you can look back on your trip up the mountain. Looking back on the whole thing, it was awesome. For about a minute, I was the highest woman on the planet, and that is really cool. It was a very proud feeling, but you don't feel it until you touch back down in base camp and you realize what you've done. I was in the scouts because my dad was the group scout leader, and I definitely have tried to follow in his footsteps quite a bit. Conquering Mount Everest was the fifth stop in Kirsty's mission to complete the seven summits. Having already reached the top of Africa's Mount Kilimanjaro, Mount Elbrus in Europe, Denali in North America, and South America's highest, Aconcagua. Kirsty completed her climb of Mount Elbrus, located in Russia, in 2019, 25 years after her father accomplished the same feat. She also reached the summit of Denali in 2022, July, which was the 41st anniversary of Tom ticking it off his list. Kirsty suffered a setback during her preparations for Everest 2 years ago after sustaining a serious shoulder injury while skiing in the Cairngorms. Despite several surgeries and grueling rehabilitation, Kirsty never managed to regain the full use of her dominant arm. Kirsty credits the extensive time she spent in the mountains as being paramount to her mental and physical recovery, putting her fully back on the path to climb Everest. She said, "The hardest part was having to use the one arm the whole time. I'm left-handed, and usually you can switch arms so that you can catch a break, but I had to use my non-dominant arm the whole way up, and that was the hardest thing. There was definitely some anxiety from not knowing if the next part of the mountain would be too hard to do with one arm, but it was all fine. 2 years to the day after my skiing accident, I walked into Camp 2 on Everest. I think that if that was as far as I had ever got, I would still have been thrilled." This article was by Chris Folds. From The National, Tuesday the 8th of August 2023, from the news section. Stephen Flynn on Rebuilding Trust Within the Independence Movement by Adam Robertson. The SNP's Westminster leader has said he is confident the independence movement will come together once we are able to have a referendum. In an interview with the Herald, Stephen Flynn was asked how to rebuild trust with independence activists who may have become disillusioned. Flynn singled out the First Minister for praise, saying that Hamza Youssef has done well since succeeding Nicola Sturgeon. "He's trying to be as calm and open as possible with people across the country. He's not been afraid to say that he didn't know about the issues around party funds, rather than pretend that everything is fine," he said. "I have the utmost respect for the way he's handled a very difficult period. He's a dad and a husband, and to come out the other side with a smile on his face and with some vigour says a lot about him as a person and a leader. I'm still confident that when we're able to have a referendum, all the grief can be put to one side and we'll come together again. We all still believe in the same end goal." However, when asked if the SNP should be working closer with Alex Salmond's Alba Party, Finn said he didn't believe there is a single seat they could win. Alba have previously said they believe all parties who support Scottish independence should stand under a single banner at the next general election. It's a move which has caused debate with SNP MP Pete Wishart, branding the plan ridiculous. Various ideas on the best route forward to securing an independence referendum were discussed at a convention in June. Suspended MP Angus McNeill was also critical of the SNP, saying that they need to prioritise independence over the party. On Alba, Flynn said, "I'm a member of the Scottish National Party, so no one should be surprised when I say that if you want independence, you should vote for us. Alba is polling between 1 and 2%. No one can show me a seat they can possibly win. The SNP is the only party that can deliver independence." Flynn was also asked about comments made by Mike Russell following Sturgeon's resignation, in which he said the party was facing its biggest crisis in 50 years. Asked if he agreed with this, the Aberdeen South MP said, "Look, I'm a Dundee United fan. I spent 18 years as a disabled person. I like a challenge. So I'm less focused on what's happened and people's opinions about it than on how we can use those challenges to get to a better position. And if you think your mindset is not on that at the moment, and this isn't a criticism of anyone, and not what's on happening to the public, then you're in the wrong place. The public will expect nothing less than us to be focused entirely on their issues." This article is by Adam Robertson.
From the National, Tuesday the 8th of August 2023, from the Culture section, fairy pools help crown Isle of Skye as most popular Scottish tourist destination. Report by Adam Robertson. An iconic Scottish island has featured on a list of the best places to visit across the UK. While there are numerous beautiful spots to enjoy all across Scotland, analysts from InsureMy analysed hashtags on Instagram to find the 10 most Instagrammable destinations in the UK. The research showed that the Isle of Skye is officially Scotland's most popular tourist destination on the social media platform and the 10th most popular in the UK. With more than 990,000 posts on Instagram, the scenic island was called a must-visit destination for hikers. The fairy pools in particular proved a popular destination, with many users posting photos of the waterfalls. The Sunday National previously spoke with a leading figure at the charity which took over Skye's fairy pools, who said that over-tourism at the spot had calmed. Other highlights in Skye include the Old Man of Storwalk, the Neist Point Lighthouse and Dunvegan Castle. As for the rest of the list, the Lake District took top spot with 4.9 million posts on Instagram. An InsureMy spokesperson said, "With the ongoing cost of living crisis, many people are choosing to forgo a trip abroad and stay in Britain." These findings feature various iconic attractions or destinations in the country. For instance, the Lake District and Peak Districts are great spots for hikers and campers. The list has something suitable for everyone, with a harmonious blend of cultural significance, historical importance, and natural splendour. And that article was by Adam Robertson. From the National, Tuesday the 8th of August 2023, from the Culture section, back in the day, looking back at Scotland's vital monumental past, by Hamish McPherson. In this latest column, the fifth in a 12-part series about Scotland's built heritage, I will be writing about monuments, both ancient and relatively modern, across Scotland. I am taking the word in its widest sense, with my definition being that monuments are about remembering people and events. Proving their worth as part of our built heritage, many of them have become landmarks visited by locals and tourists alike. As I wrote in part 1, we are truly fortunate to live in a beautiful country and, for the most part, we humans have added well to the beauties of nature. I would contend that the monuments of Scotland have, for the most part, added greatly to Scotland's attractions, but, in writing about the best of these, it would take 10 nationals to mention them all. I will make my own choice of the best and most important. As I have often explained, I do not believe you can tell the history of a nation without knowing about its built heritage and, by their very nature, memorial monuments are the stuff of the context of Scottish history. Again, I don't expect every reader to agree with my choices today, but they all have a story to tell, and all make their contribution to our history. Apologies in advance if I have left out your favourite, but email me at nationalhamish@gmail.com and I'll choose the best examples. Think about this, there are literally hundreds of thousands of monuments across Scotland. They're in the form of memorial headstones in graveyards and cemeteries, and, in their simplest form, they're historical. They tell of a person and usually when they lived and died. The trade of monumental sculpture is practiced across the country, and their products can vary from the basic to the truly ornamental, sometimes with tributes to the dead person. There is only one which is inscribed with a poem to his father by your national bard, Robert Burns. On the gravestone of his father William in Alloway Kirkyard, it states on one side, "Sacred to the memory of William Burns, formerly in Lochley, who died on the 13th of February 1784, in the 63rd year of his age." And, on the other side, this epitaph is written, "O ye, whose cheek the tear of pity stains, draw near with pious reverence and attend. Here lie the loving husband's dear remains, the tender father and the generous friend, the pitying heart that felt for human woe, the dauntless heart that feared no human pride, the friend of men, to vice alone a foe, for even his feelings lean to virtue's side." A uniquely magnificent tribute to his father by Burns, whose words can be found on many a headstone, all of them being memorials for people. The most ancient monuments in Scotland were created, modern day science has mostly decided, as aid memoirs for astronomical purposes. The 5,000-year-old standing stones at the Callanay on Lewis and, possibly, the similarly ancient Ring of Brodgar on Orkney mainland were erected by our forebears for reasons we still do not fully understand, although their usage as pointers to seasonal sun or moon measurements seems possible. They are among hundreds of official ancient stone monuments scattered mainly across the north of Scotland and the Isles, and all of them at one time or another were vital additions to the landscape. My particular favourites are the mysterious Pictish stones, which we still don't fully understand. The huge Swinus stone at Forres, erected by the Picts in the 9th century, is a must-see for anyone enthralled, as I am, by the history such as we have of the Pictish people. I will be dealing in a future column with church buildings and will show how many of them have become monuments in themselves. But I'm keeping things secular this week and, as this is defined as an ancient monument by Historic Environment Scotland and UNESCO's World Heritage Committee, the near 1900-year-old Antonine Wall is a good place to start. Built as the northernmost edge of the Roman Empire between 142 and 156 AD, the 39-mile-long wall stretched from Old Kilpatrick on the Clyde to Carradon on the Forth. It was abandoned after only 8 years, and its troops removed south to Hadrian Wall, as those pesky Caledonians just would not stop attacking it. What's left of it stands as the biggest memorial to the Roman occupation of Scotland. There are hundreds of cairns, brochs, and what remains of forts scattered across the Highlands and Islands, and many of them are scheduled as ancient monuments. Caithness alone has dozens of brochs and sites of what might have been brochs, and I pay tribute here to the Caithness Brochs Project, a charity which is aiming to promote the built heritage of the ancient county of Caithness. The largest Iron Age broch, usually a fortified roundhouse, in Caithness is Achfara Stall between Thurso and Reay, which has been made accessible by the project and which is a scheduled monument. You get a really good idea of what broch living was like at Achfara Stall. Yet, brochs and cairns are not just northern phenomena. Other scheduled monument is Edens Hall Broch, which is near Duns at the Scottish borders, and which dates from the 2nd century. It is one of the largest brochs in Scotland at 28 metres in circumference. The well-kept remains suggest that it was not as tall as Caithness Brochs, but again you get a great idea of broch living just by standing inside it. That's just a couple of scheduled monuments, but you can find an exhaustive list on the website of Historic Environment Scotland, HES, one of whom's predecessors was the Royal Commission on the Ancient and Historical Monuments of Scotland, RCAHMS. The Commission worked over decades to compile the list of monuments which can now be found on the HES website. Picking favourites. Now to more modern monuments in their usual sense of memorials. As I wrote, I'm going to choose my own favourites and we'll start with one of the most unusual and neglected memorial monuments in Scotland, the Star Pyramid in Stirling. Adjacent to the Old Town Cemetery of Stirling, host of monuments in itself, the Star Pyramid is, according to the cemetery website, a massive sandstone ashlar pyramid which dominates this area, standing on a stone step base upon a shaped grassy mound. Marble Bibles rest on the beach of on the base of each face of the pyramid, which is also carved with references to biblical texts. It was erected in 1863 by a local man, William Drummond, who was a surveyor, nurseryman and religious preacher. He commissioned the pyramid from the artist and sculptor William Barclay as a memorial dedicated to all those who suffered martyrdom in the cause of civil and religious liberty in Scotland, as it says on the website. It is stark and beautiful in its plainness. Drummond was a Scottish patriot who contributed trees that were planted around the second of my favourites, the nearby National Wallace Monument. The hero of the Battle of Stirling Bridge in 1297 was memorialised in song and poetry, but no national monument existed until a revival of public appreciation Scottish history in the 19th century. The monument website explains, in the Victorian era there was an increased interest in Scotland's past and a desire to build monuments to famous Scots. There was talk as early as 1818 about a national memorial to remember Scotland's hero, William Wallace. The location was also of great debate, with both Glasgow and Edinburgh being put forward. In the end, Stirling was chosen as it was the site of Wallace's greatest success. The Reverend Charles Rogers proposed the National Monument in 1851, and the £20,000 cost was raised by public subscription. There were 106 designs entered into the competition to create the monument, and John Thomas Rocklehead won it. You can see his original designs at the Wallace Monument to this day. The website states, it was on Monday, 24th June 1861, the anniversary of the Battle of Bannockburn, that the country at last made an effort to atone for its neglect of the memory of Wallace, as thousands of men, women and children made their way from all across Scotland to witness the laying of the foundation stone on the Abbey Craig. Who knows if it really is Wallace's sword in the monument, which opened to the public on September 11, 1869, the 572nd anniversary of the Battle of Stirling Bridge. Another massive memorial to a great Scotsman can be found in Edinburgh. The Sir Walter Scott Monument, now in the care of Edinburgh Council, was erected in Princes Street Gardens, and it has become emblematic of the city where Scott lived and worked for so long. Again, its cost was raised by public subscription organised by leading figures in Edinburgh, but there is a tragic tale to be told about the man who won the competition to design it. George Michael Kemp was an obscure son of a shepherd who was inexperienced as an architect when his design for a Gothic memorial won the competition in 1740. He was a master of works on the project when, in March 1844, just a few weeks before the monument was due to be completed, he fell in the Union Canal and drowned. The 200-foot high monument with its 287 steps to the viewing platform and the statue of Scott by Sir John Steele is now indelibly linked to the great author and poet and is a landmark in Edinburgh's cityscape. Another landmark rather to the north of Edinburgh is Glenfinnan Monument at the head of Loch Shiel, erected to commemorate the clansmen who gave their lives in the 1745-46 Jacobite Rising. Now in the care of the National Trust for Scotland, NTS, it is both a surprisingly inspired but a simultaneously desperately sad place, given all those who died under the standard of Prince Charles Edward Stuart, which he raised at Glenfinnan on August 19, 1745. The NTS website does not shirk its connection to the slave trade, stating, the monument was commissioned 70 years after the event it remembers by local landowner, Alexander MacDonald of Glenaladale, a descendant of those who supported Charles Edward Stuart in 1745. He died at the age of 28 in the year it was completed. The monument was an act of extravagance from a young man renowned for living a life of excess and reckless consumption, something we know from legal documents relating to the debts he left behind him. His own wealth was inherited from his father, Sandy MacDonald, who purchased the Glenalladale estate in the 1770s. On returning to Scotland after making a fortune in Jamaica at the height of the transatlantic slave trade. Even knowing that connection, it's still a favourite of mine and, like NTS, I believe we should explain all slavery connections on monuments and statues. I'll be looking at statues next week. Coming right up to date, one of my favourite monuments is the Commando Memorial near Speen Bridge in Lochaber, commemorating the fact that the Commando Force used the local area around Achnahari Castle for training. Dating from 1952, it is a simple design. Three statues of Marine Commandos looking outwards to Glen Speen and Ben Nevis, but it is a truly stunning part of our built heritage due to its location. It has a plaque which states, "In memory of the officers and men of the Commandos who died in the Second World War 1939-1945, this country was their training ground." And that article was written by journalist Hamish McPherson. From the National, 3rd to the 10th of August 2023, from the news section. Scottish airport climate protest set for shooting season start. Article by Laura Pollock. A campaign group is set to protest against grouse shooting and private flights on one of the busiest days in the sports calendar, as both are disproportionately damaged and need to end. August the 12th, also known as the Glorious 12th, marks the first day of the Red Grouse shooting season. Extinction Rebellion's regional Dundee group is to gather at 11 a.m. on Saturday the 12th outside Dundee Airport for the Inglorious 12th demonstration. The group has said the shooting sport has huge environmental costs and people must demand cheaper, efficient, accessible public transport in the face of private and commercial jets. Dundee Airport is used for private and chartered flights, both providing campaigners with major concerns given aviation's contribution to the current climate disaster. While there is some uncertainty around the extent of land managed as grouse moor in Scotland, it is estimated to cover between 1 to 1.5 million hectares, 12% to 18% of the country's landmass. One campaigner called the use of land crazy and even worse, people are flying in to do this killing. Anne Campbell, a retired midwife involved in the direction, said, "It is crazy that 50% of Scotland's total land area should be giving over to breeding animals just to be shot, and, even worse, people are flying in to do this killing. As an ex-midwife, I worry about the future of all the wee babies I've delivered. I see planes coming into this airport as something that is destroying these kids' future. Flying has the biggest negative effect on the environment of any form of transport, and here we have people flying into Dundee to kill birds for fun. Humans have created a blanket of pollution which is heating up and destroying our world. We need to take action to reduce this and put a stop to unnecessary flying." The proposed Wildlife Management and Muirburn Bill, currently going through the Scottish Parliament, aims to stop the illegal persecution of birds of prey by introducing a licensing regime for grouse moors. It will also further regulate or even ban the use of certain wildlife traps and extend the existing licensing regime for Muirburn. The RSPB's bird crime report from 2021 found there were 108 incidents of bird of prey persecution across the whole of the UK that year, with 71% linked to land managed for game bird shooting. One campaigner, Robbie Kelly, called the shifting of responsibility of the climate crisis to consumers as disingenuous, but said it is a consumer's responsibility to demand better transport options. He said, "Yes, we urgently need system change to tackle climate change, and the disingenuous shifting of responsibility to consumers' lifestyle choices is just that, a disingenuous diversionary tactic aimed at maintaining the status quo. But one meaningful lifestyle choice the consumer can make is to demand cheaper, efficient, accessible public transport that actually works and is pleasant to use, so that they can fly less. We have to talk openly about dismantle the massive, largely hidden apparatus of subsidies that supports the oil and gas industries, and that keeps cheap flights in the air, among other things." And an article was written by Laura Pollock. from The National. Thursday the 10th of August 2023 from the news section. Top Scottish judges slam Tory attacks on lefty lawyers. By Hamish Morrison. Scotland's top judges have delivered a damning verdict on Tory attacks on lefty lawyers, accusing senior UK government figures of attempting to politicise the legal profession. In a submission to the Scottish Government's call for views on its plans to reform legal regulation, the senators of the College of Justice, the judges who preside over Scotland's highest courts, singled out Prime Minister Rishi Sunak for recent comments which cast aspersions on lawyers in England. He said in a tweet that some lawyers were propping up a system of exploitation which profited from illegal migration, in a post that sparked widespread outrage. Former Prime Minister Boris Johnson also made repeated attacks on the legal profession, accusing lawyers who challenged his policies in court of trying to frustrate the UK government for political ends. The group of judges were responding to a public consultation on the Scottish Government's proposed regulation of legal services, Scotland Bill, and ward ministers, their plans were a threat to the independent judiciary. Warning that the UK government was already engaging in political attacks on lawyers and judges, the group called on the Holyrood administration to stay out of the legal sphere. The submission read, "The dangers of transferring aspects of regulatory power over the legal profession from the judiciary to the government, as proposed in this bill, cannot be overstated. Recently, we have seen attacks on lawyers by politicians who have, on multiple occasions, publicly criticised lefty activist lawyers for hamstringing the justice system by challenging the government in court. To give a recent example, on July 25th, 2023, the Prime Minister said, "The Labour Party, a subset of lawyers, criminal gangs, they're all on the same side, propping up a system of exploitation that profits from people getting people to the UK illegally." In response, the Bar Council for England and Wales said, "Lawyers are not beyond reproach, and all professions have individuals who commit misconduct and are dishonest. Regulators are there to discipline them." The comments by the Prime Minister, however, are clearly an attempt to play politics with the legal profession. This damaging rhetoric undermines the rule of law, trust in lawyers, and confidence in the UK legal system, and is to be deplored. That illustrates why neither political nor government regulation is an appropriate model for regulation of the legal profession. It is of critical constitutional importance that there is an independent legal profession, willing and able to stand up for the citizen against the government of the day. Legal profession under political control. As it stands, the Lord President of the Court of Session, Lord Carloway, has sole regulatory power over the Scottish legal profession, independent from government and parliament. The Scottish Government's proposed bill would give ministers the powers to take into their own hands powers to control lawyers, according to the country's top judges. Their warning added the bill would remove aspects of the Court of Session's oversight of the legal profession and see the Scottish Government impose itself as a regulator of the legal profession. The statement, signed by all of Scotland's senior judiciary, went on, "These proposals are a threat to the independence of the legal profession and the judiciary. It is of critical constitutional importance that there is a legal profession which is willing and able to stand up for the citizen against the government of the day. The judiciary is fundamentally opposed to this attempt to bring the legal profession under political control. If the bill is passed in its current form, Scotland will be viewed internationally as a country whose legal system is open to political abuse. The Scottish Government's bill is informed by the recommendations of an independent review of the legal profession by Esther Robertson." The public consultation on the bill closed on August the 9th. And that article was by Hamish Morrison. From The National, Thursday the 10th of August 2023, from the comment section, "Labour's offer to Scotland is utterly dismal. Here's why." By Professor Richard Murphy. If you are a certain age, call it my age, then you will be familiar with the feeling that as a person of the left of centre inclination, you should vote Labour. Like me, you probably always had reservations, but the feeling persisted. For many in Scotland, that residual feeling of guilt for voting anything else was destroyed by 2015, when Jim Murphy, no relation, and the referendum campaign shattered the myth for many that there was any reason left to vote for Labour in Scotland. The SNP landslide of that year was a consequence. However, opinion polls in Scotland suggest that Labour now has a chance of recovering some of the seats that it lost in the last decade, so there must be some people who have rediscovered a sense that Labour has something to offer them. I will politely suggest that they are wrong. At the risk of attracting yet more ire from Labour apparatchiks, let me set out my reasons. What do Labour have to offer? First, let me make it clear that I've always had a massive dislike for the Tory-led governments that we have suffered since 2010. Their policies have been divisive, increased inequality and prejudice, and reduced the well-being of many. They have, without exception, been economically incompetent. Can I be clearer than that? I have also, over a long period, laid out my objection to the neoliberal, pro-market, pro-austerity, pro-low tax policies that have underpinned those governments and contributed to the failures that we are now used to. Again, could they have been clearer? I doubt it. I really do wish that we could be rid of this type of government for good. Equality, sustainability, fairness, and even the future of life on Earth depend upon us doing so. In summary, the stakes could not be higher. The reason why, in that case, I am so disillusioned with Labour is that far from offering an alternative to Tory failure, they appear to me to be endorsing almost everything that the Tories have done, whilst offering more of the same in future. There are a number of good reasons for saying this. The most obvious is that Labour have committed to changing almost nothing about what the Tories have done. Brexit is accepted by them as a fact. The need for electoral reform is denied, even though their members support it. There is no hint of a change to trade union laws. Nor will Labour change the Tories' draconian approach to protesters. And they have said nothing about rolling back the anti-democratic Henry VIII powers to the UK government that gave itself during the COVID crisis. Commitments in nationalisation have also been abandoned. Labour also refused to say what they will do on quite critical issues like the NHS, migration, climate change and more. Even when commitments were made, for example on climate change, there has now been backtracking. If Labour now have a policy on anything, it is to blow in the wind. In addition, Labour are already making excuses for continuing austerity. They don't say that. Instead, they say they will have an ironclad fiscal rule. It just so happens that this means there can be no borrowing for almost everything that is needed, so we get austerity as a result. But there is no such thing as a fiscal rule. They are made up. Chancellors create and discard them on whims. No Chancellor has ever delivered upon a rule that they have created. Usually, they have revised them so many times so they can pretend that they work, but they don't. At the same time, Labour have committed to creating no new taxes on wealth in the UK, despite the fact that the effective tax rate on those with high income and wealth in the UK is dramatically lower than on most people on average or below average income. To me, all of this appears to be contrary to everything that Labour should stand for. And in Scotland, worse, Labour are also joining with the Tories in seeking to suppress the role of devolved government in this country. When, as anyone who knows them will confirm, Scotland and Wales and Northern Ireland are very different places to England, this appears to be deeply insensitive and even offensive. Added together, this appears to be a Labour package for maintaining the status quo within UK society as it is at present. Labour are offering no chance of real reform. They are ignoring the reality of this being a disunited kingdom. And they accept inequality, prejudice, lack of opportunity and low pay as if they are to be tolerated. What all this reveals is that Labour have the same profoundly neoliberal mindset that the Tories possess. There is deeply implicit in Labour's policy approach a belief that government is unable to do anything to affect change. In that case, why is anyone in Scotland thinking of voting Labour? I wish I knew, because this is making a dismal offer to the country that no one should accept when there are better options on the table. And that was an opinion piece by Professor Richard Murphy. From The National, Thursday the 10th of August 2023, from the comment section, Letters, the letters page of today's National. What difference will outcome of the next election really make? Oh, how I wish a majority of MPs from parties wanting a referendum on Scottish independence will be elected to Westminster in 2024. But wait, is that not the same idea I see before me? The one the Unionist parties at Westminster have chosen to ignore time and time again? There is no evidence that in 2024, the end result will not be the same response, along with the most powerful devolved government in the world trope being the reason for ignoring the democratic wish of the people of Scotland. The historic reality is that the English Empire does not let go of your country unless you are no longer useful to them. You give them a mighty boot in the crutch, or both. Scotland is far too useful to be let go simply in the democratic wish of the people of Scotland, as what would provide the collateral for the UK government borrowing on HS2, the long-delayed replacement Trident nuclear submarines, the rebuilding of the Palace of Westminster, and all the rest. Now folk may begin to understand why Sunak is issuing all these new licences for the UK North Sea and North Atlantic. Oil and gas are only a national asset if you are pumping them out of the ground for the next 100 years. Yet, if it becomes solely Scottish oil and gas, England has very little to offer lenders as collateral given the offshore nature of much of the City of London's trading and financial activities, and a run-down industrial base reliant on SMEs surviving the impact of Brexit and lost contracts. So please tell me why this 2024 general election result will make any difference, given the current UK government has trashed the UK economy, fed inflation by raising interest rates, making everything more expensive, and cannot face the truth. Brexit was an economic disaster, with the worst yet to come as the full impact of meeting EU regulations as a non-EU or customs union country hit home. I just do not see how this latest cunningest electoral plan will fare any better in gaining Scotland a referendum than any of the previous bold, drinking, cunning plans. Me? I'm just going to dig my steel toe-cap steaming boots out. Are you ready? Peter Thompson, Kirkcudbright. As a proud Scotsman, and rightly so, I've always wondered about the Scottish cringe. What exactly is it? According to Wikipedia, it is a cultural cringe and claimed to exist by politicians and cultural commentators. Those politicians and commentators say that the cultural inferiority is felt by many Scots due to a perceived dominance of English or Anglo-centric British culture, partly caused by the importance of London within the UK, and consequently a sense of Scottish resentment and underachievement. I'm not expressing resentment, but the fact is that the Scottish cringe is a construct by those politicians and cultural commentators to undermine Scotland's national self-confidence. They either know little or nothing of Scotland's illustrious history, or they deliberately choose to ignore it. The number of inventions and discoveries by Scots is truly amazing. Radar, television, the telephone, penicillin, vacuum flask, flushing toilet, refrigeration, pneumatic tyre, hypodermic syringe, fingerprinting, electric clock, ATA and MRI scanners. The list goes on. Those inventions and the Scottish enlightenment of David Hume and Adam Smith, two names known throughout the intellectual world, were made possible by Scotland's universities, schools and parishes. I have even touched on the subject of the many famous Scottish writers, artists and explorers. Scotland has always punched well above its weight and continues to do so today. Sir Winston Churchill praised the Scots, saying, "Of all the small nations of this earth, perhaps only the ancient Greeks surpassed the Scots in their contribution to mankind." Churchill's encomium to the Scots was recently echoed by Bill Gates, co-founder of Microsoft, when he said, "Scotland is arguably the most innovative nation in the history of the world, alongside the ancient Greeks." So much for the Scottish cringe, so much for underachievement. as the tennis player John McEnroe once vehemently protested, "You cannot be serious." Sandy Gordon, Edinburgh. I agree with both Kate Forbes and Fergus Ewing. The Greens are systematically destroying the belief in independence and support for the SNP. More was achieved by Alex Salmond with a minority government than will ever be achieved by this link with the Greens. So far, they've infuriated those in our coastal communities with their HPMA drivel and annoyed the rest of us by wasting around £90 million in a deposit return scheme. Of course, their support for Self-ID and GRA has split the SNP in two. Sturgeon used this policy to move the SNP further away from independence, and Humza is simply following suit. If we are to be independent, we need the public to believe in the competence of the Scottish Government, and that isn't possible with the Greens and a weak First Minister. However, the first thing Humza has to do to change things is to ditch the electoral liability of the Greens and then start focusing on sensible policies that the majority support, rather than tying the independence flag to divisive policies like GRA. Alex Beckett, Paisley. I was saddened to read of Kelly Giffen's diagnosis of long COVID. A dreaded diagnosis is actually giving me hope, August the 10th. She has not had it easy. Despite her medical problems, she's a woman of spirit, and even though I'm in my 70s, I appreciate her articles for their clarity and content. Like her, I share a love for Zachanathos and a belief in independence. I know what that brain fog feels like, even though it only lasted weeks with me. I don't think I could sit through the Barbie movie with her, but she explained why my granddaughters loved it. Thursday's article was as well written as ever, and I wish her a short and speedy recovery. We need people like Kelly. Colin Harvey, Kirkintilloch. And that was the letters page, the 10th of August 2023, from The National.
That concludes this week's edition of The National Podcast. Please remember to subscribe to our channels at Hune Review. Tell your friends about our service.